Welcome to On the Brink, a fresh lens to take you and your business to new heights. Hi, I'm Andy Simon, and I'm always so excited to do our podcast with you and for you. And I have so many of you out there, subscribers and listeners, who send us all kinds of emails thanking us for what we're doing to help them see, feel, and think in new ways. So I have with me today a very special man that I want you to listen to because he's going to help you like I like to. I want you to listen to Bill Flynn. Think about ways that you're doing things today and maybe should be changing them for tomorrow. Now, you know that I find people who are going to help you rethink what's going on, change the way you're doing it, begin to learn how to do things better, because sometimes what we've been doing in the past isn't necessarily working in the future. And with the fast changes that are coming on now, we're not quite sure what to do. And maybe it's time to really think about it in new ways. Who's Bill Flynn? Bill has more than 30 years of experience working for and advising hundreds of companies, including startups, small businesses, entrepreneurs. He has a long track record of success. After working for 10 different high-tech startups in different market segments, such as speech recognition, e-commerce, and affiliate marketing, where he was a VP of sales 8 times, twice as chief marketing officer, and once as general manager of a division of a $100 million IT services company, he pivoted. He's going to tell you more about his own journey, because I can only read it to you without capturing the essence of why he changed and what he learned by changing. But he turned a turnaround during that whole time, particularly at the 2008 financial crisis. He's got a lot of on-site, do it, fix it, and he had a lot of learning. And then he became a multi-certified growth coach. He has a certificate with distinction, Foundations of Neuro Leadership, and is a certified predictive index partner. He'll tell you what those all mean. And I love the neuro leadership stuff. Perhaps that was with David Rock. We'll see. Yeah. And he's an author and international speaker. He has a best-selling book, Further, Faster, The Vital Few Steps That Take the Guesswork Out of Growth, that continues to garner a 5-star rating. I think you're going to just enjoy the conversation today, because we're going to figure out all the things that we do that don't work and how to fix them in new ways. Bill, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Andrea. I've been looking forward to chatting with you since our talk a month or so ago, and it's always great to chat with like minds.
It's so much fun. Because when I met Bill, I said, well, you know, we are anthropologists who help companies change. He's going to tell you what he learned. And I must tell you that if you're just imagining it, reading books on it, it's very difficult to understand how to do it. But when you've done it, you realize that this is hard work. And so, Bill, tell us about Bill Flynn. And then we'll talk about how you can help our listeners begin to think about things through a completely different perspective. Who's Bill?
Sure. So I've had sort of two arcs to my careers, if you will. One was a startup. I've done, as you mentioned, I've done 10 startups over about 25 years. I started in the early 90s. Wow. And mostly on the internet. I was at a startup in 1995 on the internet, so very early on. At a company called Open Market, which was we were called the Netscape of the East at the time. And, you know, those heady days of only having a few million in revenue, but going public and being worth billions of dollars, you know, which was kind of ridiculous.
I'm sorry to laugh. I'm okay. Sorry. I remember it well. It was a crazy time.
So crazy. So crazy. So I did that for a long time. And you know, I did pretty well. I'd like to say I was smart and wise, but I was also probably a little bit lucky. I was 5 for 6, my first 6. So that's pretty crazy odds, right? I ended up being 5 for 10. So, you know, I should have stopped early on, but I loved it so much. A stint in between startup 5 and 6 is why I'm doing what I'm doing today, where I really had a chance to be a coach. I actually didn't know I was a coach. It was just sort of more of my style. I'm more of a collaborative style, and I believe in the people I work with and such. But it turned out to be a tremendous asset and helped to do that turnaround that you mentioned in 2008, 2009. And then I became a coach. And I don't really think I'm a coach as much as I'm a teacher more than anything. You know, I'm sure you do this. You go in between different things, right? You're an advisor sometimes, you know, you have to bite your tongue a lot because you want them to come do it on their own. You're a coach and sort of being encouraging and asking lots of really good questions. But I teach more than anything. I teach a framework. I teach what I've learned. I'm studying business for 30 years, really intensely in the last five.
Yes.
And as you mentioned earlier, I've found a number of patterns, good patterns and bad patterns. And so the reason I love doing podcasts is I want people to know that there is a way to not guess at growing your business. It's been done. There's science behind it. And most people don't know it. So I want to share that with people. And I do that in through this and through a book that I wrote, which I give away for free on my site, as well as on Amazon, Audible, all that other kind of good stuff. So that's sort of my journey to here. And now I'm a very well unknown Simon Sinek. I'm an optimist. I think there's a better way. We need to be more human, all those things.
So. Well, it's a perfect time for us to then ask, such as, what are the biggest hurdles that growing a business entails? I'm married to a serial entrepreneur. I've lived through it many times.
Sure.
You know, you've had a bunch of startups, nothing more exciting or challenging than taking an idea, turning it into an innovation, turning it into a business, making it scalable, and not saying, no, we don't, no, we can't. And even when you have a well-established company, people get real anchored to the way things have always been and really have a difficult time growing. So some of the lessons that you learned, and you can do it in many order, sort of come back and try and put them together for the listener. But, you know, what are the major obstacles that people have, the assumptions or biases they carry, and how do we get past them?
Yeah. So, well, first I'll back up and say, this is what I've learned. Here are the stats. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, if you started a company, if your husband started a company in 1994, he had a 50% chance of making it to 5 years. He had a 25% chance of making it to 15 years and about a 16% chance of making it to 25. So the longer you're in business, the more likely it is that you will go out of business. Now, of course, if you survive, it doesn't mean that you're thriving. Many of the ones that are surviving are struggling.
Yes.
But there are great examples of businesses that do well. And what I've found is on the positive side, is that, there's a great gap between what science knows and what business does. We deal a lot on intuition, conventional wisdom, and that's often wrong. and we don't find out about it for quite some time. And I think one of my theories is, I have no idea, but you'd think if we were in business longer, we'd learn stuff and we'd get better and we'd improve, right? But that's not true. And I think because of all these things that we think are right add up. And over time, they just become this tidal wave that's working against us, right? It's the tide keeps getting stronger and stronger, becoming a tsunami eventually, and then eventually it overtakes us. So there's definitely this big gap. The other thing I've really noticed on the positive side, that those companies that last endure over great periods of time, meaning generations and centuries, they do a very few things really, really well. Mm-hmm. They go deep, very much deep. Eventually they'll go wide, but they go deep first. And these are people like, you know, Alan Mulally when he was running Boeing and Herb Kelleher running Southwest, right? We're just going to do these things really well. Even Jobs at Apple to a degree, right? They do lots of stuff, but they focus on one premise, which is amazingly simple, simply amazing. Everything they do falls into that, right? No matter what is it, a watch or a phone or a television or whatever it is, that's what they focus on. And so I follow something called essentialism, which is something Greg McKeown has talked a lot about, which to me boils down to few things truly matter, but those that do matter tremendously. You know, Pareto was a genius. Mm-hmm. You know, it's true that that principle flows through our business. You know, 80 to 90% of your profits come from 10 to 20% of your companies. The clothes that you wear in your closet, most of them you wear the same things, right? It goes on and on. Land wealth, distribution, distribution of land, wealth distribution. They all fall into this thing. So if we can figure out those few things as leaders and really, really focus on them with great attention and rigor, you at least have a much better chance of not falling under the line that I mentioned earlier and being above it.
Now, you're a bit abstract. Is there a case study or two you can share that illustrate How doing the right things and sticking to them work? Because when we're working with fast changing times, it's difficult sometimes to keep your core values intact or to go deep before you go wide and not to be a shotgun that's trying to hit all the things, but a focused organization, knowing who you are and what you're doing.
Right.
And so those are wisdoms that I love. But how does somebody actually do that, particularly when everything around them appears to be disrupted? So some thoughts.
Sure. So to me, the finest CEO we've seen, at least in my lifetime, if not longer, is Alan Mulally, who I mentioned earlier. And you probably know who he is, but many people don't know who Alan Mulally is. I was a Vista speaker for about 4 years, and I would talk about, my talk was about my book, but it was mostly about two things, which was people and teams and strategy, but mostly focusing on customer. And I would talk about Alan Mulally everywhere I went. And I said, who knows who Alan Mulally is? And I asked them to raise their hand. And for folks who don't know what Vistage is, it's a peer advisory, a worldwide peer advisory group. There are, you know, between 10 and 15 CEOs in a room, and you do a 3-hour workshop. And so it's really intimate, a lot of back and forth. So I got to, I did a mini study, because I would do the same thing. I would ask the same questions and get the same answers back, which is one of the reasons I wrote my book. So Alan Mulally, for those who don't know, the reason I think he's the finest CEO we've ever had is that he was at Boeing. He ran Boeing commercial aircraft in the 90s and turned it around because they were getting their ass kicked by Airbus. If we remember, there was a big complaining about the French government and doing all these things. And he turned them around in the middle of 9/11, which is an existential crisis, economic and otherwise, for the airline industry. Yet they came out of 9/11 better than they went in. Now, that in and of itself is amazing. However, he then was asked by Bill Ford to do the same thing, which he did again at Ford. And not only did he fix Ford, he did it through 2008, another existential crisis for a different industry. Steve Jobs never did that. You know, Kelleher never did that. Sam Walton never did that. There's no CEO that has done that twice. Yet most people don't know who he is. And he did it by being very simple. If you remember at Ford, he jettisoned Jaguar and Volvo. He said, we're going to do these things. He got them focused on the Taurus again. You know, he there's a great book called The American Icon, which is about him. It's such a great read. And what I loved about it, there was a section in it that was written about how he spoke to the board. And it was, you know, I sort of joke because you have to say things very simply to board members because, you know, they're not very smart. They're smart generally.
I guess I've had a few of those.
Yeah. And he had four things. He said, these are the four things. And he told the board, and they were, I don't remember them exactly, but basically it was, we are one team at Ford. We are going to evolve our mix of products that focus on what the customer wants and values. He says, we're going to operate profitably with that current mix, and we need the cash to do that. So there's four things, which is around people, strategy, execution, and cash, yeah. Which is the essence of what I think are the four main things that most folks should great leaders should focus on if they do those things well. So that's the story I tell all the time. It's really about doing a few things. And this guy did it twice. What I love about Alan Mulally is he's a super humble guy, which I think is why we don't know about him. And the reason I know he's humble is he called me. I wrote an article about him about 2.5 years ago, and he read it.
Wow.
And he sent me an email, and we talked for about a half an hour about a month and a half, 2 months ago. And he was just a super nice guy. So what I love about that is you don't have to be Jobs or Gates or, you know, sort of this surly, churlish personality to get things done, or Elon Musk. You can still be a regular human being and run a great company.
Now, a word from our sponsors, Simon Associates Management Consultants. Simon Associates is us, and we love to help you see, feel, and think in new ways to help you and your business grow. We specialize in applying the tools and methods of anthropology, but we're also entrepreneurs and business builders, and we like to share our experience and expertise with you. So if you're stalled or stuck or starting up, give us a buzz and let's see if we can help you as well. You can learn all about us at simonassociates.net and read my book, learn about it at andysimon.com. There's a free chapter you can download and a toolkit you'll find very helpful. We're on Amazon, and you can buy it as a book, an ebook, or even an Audible that I recorded myself. We look forward to hearing from you at simonassociates.net. info@simonassociates.net is right to us. Now back to our podcast. Now, listening to you, and as I think about it from our listener's perspective, his four things sound pretty simple. You know, we have to do it with our people, worry about our strategy, manage our cash, and do what customers want. How hard is that? But it sounds like it's so hard. If so many businesses are failing, do they, from what I've seen, not really understand what the customer needs? I find they often think inside out and do so. Being an anthropologist, I have to take them exploring to really understand what it is their customers need. And not what the customer said, but watching them actually do something so they understand what it is they really need. Not a focus group where they're all pleasing each other or a survey, but watch them. I go out and spend a day in the life of a customer, even my own customers. And I say, now take a look at what they're actually doing with your product, not what you think they're doing with it. And why are they only using 10% of it? Think about it backwards, outside in. And strategy, we're blue ocean strategists. So you want to stay in a red ocean and compete, go right ahead. But if you want to really thrive, you have to create. And what he did at Ford was he wasn't a competitor for everybody else. He fixed on what the customers he wanted, his Taurus. What was it that we were going to offer that was very targeted and very effective against a particular customer, what they needed and wanted? And so then you can manage your cash flows much more effectively because you're really creating something and you're also getting your people to speak. He's saying drink the Kool-Aid, because that's really not the words. If people don't understand strategy, they'll do whatever they think is the right thing to do. They're not bad people. But if you don't communicate with them over and over again, they'll make up stories. And the stories are perfectly fine. They're the hero in the story. You really don't know what you're doing. You haven't told me. And if you are bad at storytelling, and that means the lack of ego humbling can be a highly successful leader, can't it?
Yeah.
Oh,
wow. I just keep going. And this is, you're like reading my book to everybody. This is why I was excited to be on this podcast, is that we are a rare breed, and you who talk about this kind of stuff and know of which we speak, right? Because we've been living it. We've been researching it either at a meta level or at a deep level. And a number of the things you said, we think inside out. We think we know what the customer knows, but we really don't. I'm a huge fan of Bob Mesta and the Jobs to be Done group. And I love the way he talks about you need to interrogate your customers.
Yes.
And not all customers, but the ones who are the best, the ones who love you, who you love, and who are profitable. They understand the value. And I've been doing customer discovery and customer development for years. I've done hundreds and hundreds of interviews. It's not quite what Bob does, but it's pretty close. And there's one story I love to tell. I was at a company called LiveVault. I was brought in to help them add another channel and do another things. The previous VP of sales wasn't quite cutting it. And I had friends there, and they kind of wanted me to join them anyway. So I think they just needed an excuse to bring me in. And by then I had a process. I think I had been a VP of sales three times or so. And I said, here's the deal. I'm going to be here for the first 2 weeks or so. Don't expect anything from me. I'm not going to say, here's what we're doing. Here's our plan. I want to go talk to our customers, and not any customers. I want to talk to our best customers. Could you give me a list? And they said, what do you want to talk to them about? I said, well, I just kind of want to get to know them a little bit, but mainly I want to know why.
Yes.
Why did they buy from us? What did we do? What are we doing for them that makes them so happy with us?
Yep.
So I got a list of about 20, and I got on the phone. It took about 2 or 3 weeks to talk to people, et cetera. And there was really one question that was the sort of the linchpin, the fulcrum of the whole thing, which was, what is the most valuable thing that you got from using our service? So we were a data backup company, and our job was to replace tape as the medium and allow them to put it up in the cloud. This was 2005, so the cloud was still, newish. And I don't even think it was called the cloud yet. It might have just been starting. I did this in 1998, and we were called ASPs. And there was no SaaS thing. We were called something else. So I was chatting with these people, and I had this question. But before I went and did that, I said, hey, I went to the head of marketing, I went to the CEO and the person who hired me, who reported CEO, and I said, why do you think our customers buy from us? And they all said the same thing, which was insurance. And I was like, okay, well, that's not a bad answer, because at least it's more about the other person than it is about us. Because a lot of times when I ask, Vistage folks, why do people buy from you? Basically, they say, because we're awesome. We do wonderful things. Our stuff is great. Why wouldn't they buy from us? And like, okay, that's why my talk is what it is. So I said, great, but I want to talk to these people. And I went out and I talked to them and I asked these questions. And here's what I got back, Andy, is I only talked to 17 and I could have stopped at 12, but I didn't believe what I was hearing. So I said, there's got to be some pocket. There was not enough data. And when I asked that question, what I heard 12 out of the 17 times were almost the exact same words, which was set it and forget it. Mm-hmm. So we were selling insurance. They were buying time.
Yes.
So I told my sales team and everyone, I said, start saying these words because our customers are super busy, small to medium business owners who know they have to back up their data and it's important, but they don't want to do it. And they hate the whole process of tape. They hate, you know, going from the VHS and storing it here and changing the dates and doing all the stuff and worrying about whether it's going to be there or not, if they're doing it right. And they said, okay, so I can get on a browser, click a few buttons, and I never have to worry about it ever again. Uh-huh. How much does that cost? Basically, and from, I mean, I got lucky. I'm sure it was a timing issue, but we beat every month, every quarter, quarter after quarter. Iron Mountain bought us about 18 months after I got there for 10 times revenue.
Wow.
Because we proved it. They were already a partner. They knew it was coming, but we hadn't proved it yet. And they saw it. So that was really eye-opening for others. And for me, it's a great story because we thought we knew, and it wasn't a bad answer, but it, nope. And I'm sure insurance was on the list, but it was down the list. And you really got to focus on that few things, right? What's the one or two main reasons why someone buys from you? Not why you think, not why you prefer, right? We shouldn't be thinking about preference. We should be thinking about predicting their behavior, as you said, by observation as much as you can, which is really hard, but.
Well, so I'm listening to you, and I not long ago had a great client, Blue Ocean client, and I did something very similar because they couldn't go explore what their own customers were doing. But this was you'd appreciate this. This was an IT outsource consulting business that they would take the back office and they would manage it. They would manage the emails, and they would have a help desk, and they would look like about 40,000 other just similar kind of companies that had become quite commoditized. Very red ocean, lots of competition, different price points. But when I asked them for, a dozen of their clients, best clients. And what was so fascinating was the client's story started out being complimentary and immediately deteriorated into the pain points.
Yeah.
And the pain points were fascinating. They weren't all the same, but there were enough pain in 12 different fine customers. So when I played the tapes back to my clients, it wasn't what I was discovering. They had to hear it directly from the customer, and they had to hear it not one, not two, but a dozen. And all of a sudden have that epiphany when, holy crow, we're not very good at all, are we? So, well, you are another. You are imitative. That's how you designed yourself. You get irritated when customers want something that they need as opposed to what you do. You sell one size fits everyone, fits no one. And they're telling you, a dozen of them are telling you that that doesn't really fit what I need at all. So you're shoving it into a box. It's time to create a whole new sandbox. And they did. And we wrote the plan over a long weekend. And next thing you know, they're bringing in some of their biggest clients ever, not by pushing out what they do, but by understanding what they need. They were in perfect position when the pandemic hit because they were all remote anyhow, and they were beginning to really understand what was going on in a remote workforce. What was so interesting, though, is that the customers are there. It doesn't take a lot to listen, not survey them. It's not a net promoter score. You got to get closer to their stories because it's in the story that people capture the essence of what's happening. And if you don't listen to their stories, you don't have a clue. But they'll tell you what they think you want to hear. But if you ask them to tell you stories about it, all kinds of deep stuff come out. And businesses are stories. People buy the story, to your point. They were selling insurance. People weren't buying that at all. They were setting it and clicking it and going to sleep at night. And they had peace of mind, but that's not an insurance policy. That's maybe how you package it, but the benefit, the feeling, and we buy with the heart, not with the head. It's not in the head. It's the heart stuff. So this is really just a delightful conversation, very important for the folks who are listening, because these are fast-changing times. We didn't expect a pandemic. I used to preach, if you want to change, have a crisis or create one. You don't really want to. You were brought in because the sales guy wasn't selling well. It was a crisis. But I never want to waste a crisis. So as people are listening about today's unusual economy, where some are growing faster than ever and others aren't growing at all, any wisdom that you can share with them about how to think about this in a fresh way?
Yeah. So what I've learned is there are three things that matter the most. And I've already sort of mentioned them from Alan Mulally. I boil them down into three sort of pithy little things, right? Which is performance is a team sport. Mm-hmm. According to some research from Marcus Buckingham and ADP, about 80% of us or so are on at least one team. Mm-hmm. Another 60 to 70% of us are on at least two teams and more. But most of those teams, especially in larger organizations, are not represented in the org chart. So at any point in time, someone who isn't appointed as a team leader is a team leader, yet we don't teach people how to run teams well. Yes. That's one of the things I mentioned that you talked, off air, is we do a whole bunch of things wrong, or for the most part, we do them wrong. One of them is teams. And the ability to attract, craft, build a team around a particular key function is a huge asset. And it is a skill. And mostly, to be honest with you, I equate it mostly to being a parent. It's paying attention and understanding the strengths and the differences amongst your children, so to speak, mm-hmm. and trying to get them to use those as often as they can. They're not going to be able to do it all the time. And I talk to folks all the time. I do this thing called the key process flow map, where we basically lay out the by key function, how you make money. And then I talk about, there are individual functions within those. And the job description is something that we've inherited from the past. I said, those were made up. So why can't you just make up the team? If you have someone who's really good at something, yet it's not sort of in their role, then either change their role or change the definition of their role or put them into something else, because they're going to be better at it than probably anyone else. They're going to love what they're doing. So they're going to be energized. They're going to be a great teammate. They're going to probably modify it and improve it because they get into it so much. Yet we don't do that. We're like, well, you need to fix your weaknesses. Right? You need to get better at this. And I know, and again, I'm a huge Marcus Buckingham fan. He has proven this over and over again, that doesn't work. Yeah. If you want excellence, if you want to fix weaknesses, then you can avoid failure, but that's not excellence. Right? That's not going further, faster, right? Yes. So I think that's definitely one of the things we have to do. We have to remember that performance is a team sport. Really focus on how to do that. And I highly recommend Amy Edmondson or the stuff from Buckingham and Goodall and Nine Lies About Work. That's something that you can do there. The second thing is you have to really understand it. You've already said it, is strategy and execution are two sides of the same coin.
Yes, they are.
One of the things I did when I was doing Visage, I would ask, and I would say, what would happen if I asked your team, I go to your Monday morning senior leadership team meeting and I just walked in and said, hey, could everybody just take out a pen and a pencil and write down your version of the current company strategy? And I had them read it out loud. What do you think would happen? And they all start laughing, right? And yes. I said, yeah. So I know that you're sometimes frustrated with people on your team. I said, maybe they're executing really well on the wrong thing. Yes. So your job is to get them on the same page because they're executing the strategy or their version of it. Yes. So that's totally, we do that all the time. I got to tell you, 90% of the time, the people, and these Invistage folks are some pretty heavy hitters. These are hundreds of million dollar companies, a few billion dollar organizations have been around for generations.
Yes.
And they weren't comfortable with that question. So somehow they're surviving. I don't know, through momentum or I don't know what it is. And then lastly, if you want to grow, now remember, I'm a 30-year sales and marketing guy. Revenue is vanity. Profit is sanity. Cash is king. If you want to grow, cash should be your primary financial growth metric. Why? Because growth costs money. Yes. And you have to spend in front of growth. So what you should do is put together your 3-year plan and then say, okay, how much will this cost us? How many factories do we need? How many people do we need? How many tools do we have to buy? Okay, great. How do we sell stuff? So we can generate the money to pay for this stuff. And it's super simple. It's hard. So simple to say, hard to do. So those are the three things that I would always recommend. Again, it's in my book. It's free online if you want to download it. And I have exercises that go with my book to walk through all these things as well. There are 25 exercises that go with the book. They're free as well. I just think it's a shame that really good companies, really good ideas, and really good people struggle or die for completely preventable reasons. And I want to do something about it.
Well, I do think that you said at the beginning that you're a coach and a teacher, but in some ways you need to also be an inspiration for the folks who are listening and elsewhere. I mean, I'm a Vistage speaker. I've done 450 of them, so I get it. And those CEOs often came to hear about Blue Ocean Strategy or how to make change, you know, change matters. But regardless of what it was, you need to be inspirational for them to listen and for their minds to begin to open up. And we're experiential learners. And so the more we can urge our listeners to do this, the sooner they can turn Bill Flynn's ideas into key learnings that your organization will say, where'd you get that from? That really works. I want to emphasize your point about teams, though. We have two leadership academies for two clients, large hospital systems and whatever. But the word leadership, I've become suspicious of, because in this remote work or the kind of changes, I'm looking for followership, teams.
Yeah.
You can't get the job done as a leader unless someone follows you. And you're following somebody else. But we've got it all mixed up. And Barbara Kellerman's work, the Harvard sociologist and historian, has a wonderful literature on followership that I've become a real fan of, because you got a half of the bucket, but not the other, which goes to teams. You don't need job descriptions. You need often ad hoc solution providers that come together with a problem to solve and be amazed at how well they do it, and then go back to doing other things as well. There's a lot of elasticity now, particularly, you know, love your remote workers, because they're looking for problems to solve, not necessarily structure to fit into or boxes to live in.
Yeah.
So use the opportunity to follow Bill Flynn and begin to think about both the way in which we team up, but also how to generate cash. In Blue Ocean thinking, we say, get your price, pull out cost to get your margin. Because often we add value and add cost. And that's a very bad way to run a business, but we do that. And so you add staff, you add costs, but not enough revenue to cover it. So you end up living out of those that are making a profit and you end up with no cash. It's wrong. Now's the time to really rethink, what's my right margins here and how do I get there? So it's a great time. Bill, if they'd like to reach you for some consulting or to download your book or the toolkits with it, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
Yeah, sure. I'll just confirm what you said is leadership ain't a thing. I think this $15 billion industry that is leadership is made up out of myths.
I agree.
People argue with me all the time on LinkedIn. I'm like, it's not, and I'm with you. It's followership. We should study followership more deeply and figure out how to do that. So reach me, best way is on my website, which is catalystgrowthadvisors.com. My book is there. All the stuff I write is there. My calendar is there. You can book some time with me. You can call me, you know, whatever you want to do is get on my website. That's the best way to find me.
Well, and I'm sure in our podcast blog that we put up, we'll have all that information for the listeners. And you might even think about sending along some questions for Bill. I have a hunch he's the kind of guy who'd be delighted to hear from you and answer your questions, because sometimes you need a tip. You don't necessarily need a full coach. You just need, I have a problem. How do I solve it? But these are times where a lot of sharing is going on. And it's so exciting from my perspective to see how many folks have come to be on our podcast who say, I just have to share. And so it's a really special opportunity for us to share great folks. Bill Flynn is a great guy. You're going to love reading his book. And I think you're just going to enjoy learning from him as I have. So for those of you who come all the time and send us great emails, keep them coming. And don't forget to send along folks you'd like to hear about or from. And it's always wonderful to hear your thoughts and get your questions. We have a book, Rethinks, Smashing the Myths of Women in Business. It comes out in January 2021. And I think you're going to enjoy it as a follow-up to On the Brink, A Fresh Lens to Take Your Business to New Heights. We wrote it to help women get role models to see how they can become the best that they can be. And with it, we've developed a program to help you do the same. It'll be online with coaching support and groups to help you begin to think about, where are you going? How do I get there? If I can help a business change, can't we also help you as an individual change? And that's our purpose going forward, because it's great to change the business, but we're basically helping individuals in that business. And these are great times for us to rethink who we are and where we're going. So thanks for joining On the Brink with Andy Simon. Share away, enjoy, have a great day. Please stay healthy, and best to you. Bye-bye.